Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Perron. We began actually at the beginning of today's program looking at the situation of Japan concerning the Fukushima nuclear power plant. The head of Japan's Nuclear Regulation Authority has warned that the crisis at the plant is far from over, describing the situation as unstable. He says the situation is changing every day with various risks. He also warned that more contaminated water from the Rume plant is being pumped into the Pacific Ocean, as the huge amounts of coolant water could not be stored at Fukushima indefinitely. Sam Bolito reports from Tokyo.
It's been more than 2.5 years since Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant was crippled by the effects of an earthquake followed by a tsunami. It was the worst atomic disaster in a quarter of a century, and the plant is still in crisis.
Fukushima remains unstable. Even now, with the current problem of reactor coolant and water contamination unresolved, we can say the crisis has not ended.
There are more than 300,000 tons of contaminated water being stored at the Fukushima plant, with hundreds of tons being added every day. But those in charge appear at a loss to explain what they'll do with it all.
Once the water is processed, it won't be a question of purifying the water, but more about throwing it away somehow, and it may not be possible to avoid dumping it into the sea.
Japan's Prime Minister says the time's come for quick decisions.
We cannot have the ad hoc or after-the-fact measures that we've had in the past. We have to take drastic action on this.
The government's promising a comprehensive package of measures to tackle the water problem.
We cannot let the issue of water contamination at Fukushima be dealt with by TEPCO alone. From now on, the government will lead and look to provide a comprehensive solution.
The new measures come amid a proposal to create a government agency devoted to decommissioning the Fukushima plant. Meanwhile, others outside the government are calling for TEPCO, the plant's operator, to be broken up.
As Sam Bolito was reporting the latest developments about the problems facing the crippled Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan is now presenting fresh political challenges for the government of Shinzo Abe. For the first time in over 2 years, the Japanese government is now looking at taking apart TEPCO. This would mean the government would have to set up a new agency to take care of the problem of cleanup. Next, Sen Lam speaks to Richard Tanter, a senior research associate at the Nautilus Research Institute, about the next course of action for the Shinzo Abe government.
Well, I think it's extremely important in material terms, the revelations about the new hotspots, about the leaks into the ocean, the continuous groundwater coming into the basement of the turbine rooms, and as your correspondent said, the extraordinary problems of the storage of more than 300,000 tonnes. This is not a new problem. It's really been there since the beginning. And the question now is, how important is this politically? And that's why Prime Minister Abe has moved to today to begin to set up a new government process beyond TEPCO.
Indeed, as you say, the government says it's not just up to TEPCO, and now it will have to come up with a solution. Quite how well-equipped is the Japanese government to do that? Will they need help from overseas experts, for instance?
Well, they certainly will need help from overseas, but one of the core problems was, as your correspondent mentioned, the government is considering setting up an agency, a government agency, for decommissioning Fukushima and perhaps other plants in the future. The core point there, however, is there really has been no effective decommissioning, I should say, of a commercial nuclear power plant anywhere in the world. This is a long, even in the best of times, this is a 20, 30-year process. So Japan is embarking on this under the worst possible circumstances. And of course, all but one of the nuclear power plants, the 55 in Japan, is closed down, and the last one closes down in a week and a half from now. And that will again raise the issue of what other plants really have to be decommissioned rather than starting up again.
And Professor Tanter, it's been over 2 years since the disaster, and of course the situation, as we've just found out, is far from stable. In layman terms, what do you think is the biggest technical challenge facing the ruined nuclear plant to make it safe again?
Well, the first one and the most immediate one is the news that the reactor Reactor Unit 4, the one which had a very large amount of stored fuel in its fuel storage pool, but that is sinking. According to former Prime Minister Kan Naoto, that has sunk some 31 inches in places, and it's not uneven. And this is really not surprising, given the what's happened in terms of the pumping of water, the aftermarkets of the earthquake and the tsunami, but the continual infusions of water into the groundwater area. This is an immediate problem, and if it is not resolved, there is an extraordinary possibility we really could be back at March 2011 again, because of the possibility of a fission accident in that spent fuel pond in Unit Number 4. Beyond that, the core question is, what on earth are they going to do with this huge amount of water which has been contaminated? And that problem has been there with day one. And it's worth just pointing out that while the economy minister, Mr. Motegi, in Prime Minister Abe's administration, has now turned onto TEPCO, which indicates that, as with previous Prime Minister Kan Naoto, the government has lost trust in TEPCO, and he said that TEPCO has been playing whack-a-mole, and now it's time for the government to take some comprehensive action. It's entirely reasonable to ask why that was not clear when the Abe government came into power more than a year ago. And so to that extent, there is a certain amount of posturing going on, and it's not clear, really, what the Japanese government can do beyond setting up a new agency to do this. What we really need to see is comprehensive plans for shutting down Fukushima completely and safely. That's not on the horizon yet.
And the political implications aside, just very briefly, if the hundreds of tons of contaminated water has to be pumped into the Pacific, what does this mean? How dangerous is this?
Well, if they're talking about pumping the larger part of the 300,000 tons they have at present, that's extraordinary. The levels of contamination that we've been finding and hearing about in the new hotspots presumably are also diffusing into that contaminated water. This is the core problem which is faced from the beginning. If that water goes into the Pacific Ocean, it will circulate, and putting it mildly, the views of the neighbouring countries are going to be very dire indeed.
Richard Tatter speaking with Sen Lam. Thailand's public health ministry is planning to press on with tougher anti-tobacco measures despite a legal setback. Plans to increase the size of graphic warnings on cigarette packets were recently put to hold by a successful legal challenge from big tobacco companies. Despite that, Thailand remains one of the leaders for tobacco control in the region. Beer Bertels has more from Bangkok.
Thailand is one of the most ambitious countries in Southeast Asia when it comes to tobacco control measures. Cigarette packets sold there are required by law to be half-covered in gruesome health warnings. But in April this year, the country's health ministry decided to increase the size of the warnings to cover 85% of each packet. In the past week, that plan was halted, with an administrative court in Bangkok upholding a legal challenge to the implementation of the new law. Global tobacco giant Philip Morris International this week issued a statement saying,
"The decision now clears the way for us to show the court that this measure is not only illegal but also unnecessary, given that the health risks of smoking are universally known in Thailand."
Philip Morris went on to point out that the health warnings won't apply to cheap roll-your-own tobacco, which the company says makes up half of Thailand's market. Several other major tobacco companies have also taken action over the Thai government's plan. Mary Asunta Kollandai is a senior policy advisor for the Southeast Asia Tobacco Control Alliance. She says the tobacco companies are fearful about the impact of larger graphic warnings.
Just logic would indicate that a large warning is an effective one and basically takes away the attractiveness of the pack.
She says the plan for expanded warnings would make Thailand a world leader for tobacco control.
If Thailand was allowed to institute its legislation and carry it out, then Thailand will have the largest health warning on packs in the world.
Asian countries have some of the highest smoking rates in the world. According to a report from the Tobacco Control Alliance, smoking rates across Southeast Asia range from 67% of men in Indonesia to 24% in Singapore. Female smoking rates are significantly lower. But Mary Asunta Kollandai says in recent years, real progress has been made.
There are several countries that have actually also banned publicity of corporate social responsibility activities of the tobacco companies, and these are particularly Thailand, Vietnam, Indonesia and Cambodia have actually banned the publicity. Thailand has also banned the pack display at retail outlets, just like Australia.
Health experts agree that the country of most concern in the region is Indonesia. Not only does it have the highest smoking rates, it also has fewer regulations and controls on tobacco advertising.
They are the only country in Asia that has not ratified the global treaty called the WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. And it remains the only country that has not banned tobacco advertising.
But Indonesia is planning to implement new laws next year that will mandate pictorial health warnings on cigarette packets. Dr. Kartono Muhammad from the Indonesian Public Health Association says the tobacco industry is still fighting the planned changes.
And you know, in 2014 there will be a general election, election for the president, election for the member of parliament, and I'm afraid that before this regulation is actually enacted, the tobacco industry has maybe influenced the political parties, the political figures, or bribing them, so they will make the regulation not effective anymore.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. An Australian man who is facing the death penalty for drug trafficking in Malaysia has been acquitted. The judge released Dominic Bird after the defense successfully questioned the credibility of a rogue policeman involved in the case. Zoe Daniel has more.
There was always a chance that the judge would rule swiftly once he'd made up his mind that there was reasonable doubt about Dominic Bird's guilt. Still, the Australian was surprised to find himself standing free outside the court, having been in jail in Malaysia since March 2012.
You must be extremely relieved.
Yeah, definitely. I'm still not over yet. We've got a couple of things to sort out with immigration, getting my visa sorted so I can get my ass out of here, but yeah.
And were you expecting this today?
No. No.
What's it been like for you sitting through all of those hearings? It must have been...
grueling, yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's not fun because it's such a long, bloody process and you've got 2 weeks of quarantine from the date you go to court, so... quarantines are pretty restrictive. They lock you in a cell 24 hours a day. You've got no movement at all, not even for exercise or to get out in the sun. So you just get locked up in a cell with 6 other guys.
How have you been treated in the prison?
I've been treated well. The conditions aren't good, but I've been treated well. I can't complain about the treatment that I've received.
How did you sustain yourself through all of that?
You kind of just have to get used to your surroundings and keep your mind inside. That's one of the officers told me when I first came in. And he told me that the main secret to keeping your head straight in here is just to keep your head inside the prison, not outside at home.
Dominic Bird was arrested in an undercover police sting and accused of attempting to sell 167 grams of methamphetamine to a police officer, enough to attract a compulsory death penalty under Malaysian law. But his legal team, led by barrister Muhammad Shafi, called into question the credibility of the policeman, who they accused of using drug money to lead a lavish lifestyle and entrapment of Mr. Bird. 2 weeks ago, he was charged with contempt for threatening a witness. Mr. Shafi says the defence built a case around the possibility that Mr. Bird was set up.
In fact, it attracted me to call him a rogue officer. We had an independent witness, and what he said was corroborative of what Dominic said, because he said, Dominic said he never brought the bag, and that was never his plastic bag that consisted of the drug. The court, therefore, in the light of all these contradictory evidence, held that this is not a safe case to convict.
Dominic Bird's visa expired in jail. Last night, he was on his way to immigration to get a new one so he could fly back to Perth a free man.
That was Zoe Daniel reporting. Pacific regional leaders are meeting in Marshall Islands trying to come up with a compromise resolution on Fiji. Fiji has been suspended from the Pacific Islands Forum since 2009. But with moves towards an election next year, there is increasing pressure for Fiji to be readmitted to the group. Geraldine Coote speaks next to Sean Dorney, Australian Network's Pacific correspondent.
When Prime Minister Tuilepa from Samoa was asked yesterday about Fiji, he said, "We haven't discussed it yet." And that's what's going to be coming up in the next few hours. We did ask Anote Tong about Fiji because in the past, Anote Tong has been a supporter of the readmission of Fiji. So yesterday at a press conference, we put the question to Anote Tong about what he thought the decision that should come out of this in relation to Fiji.
We will all be watching the developments, whether we can change the current status of where Fiji is at the moment, I don't know. That's something that we would again argue. We always argue over this. At the retreat, you don't hear us arguing, but we do. But I'd like to see something move. I think we have to respond with the positive developments. I think we should acknowledge those positive developments.
Anote Tong, Kiribati President. Sean Dorney, a number of the other leaders also commented, including John Key, New Zealand Prime Minister.
Yes, Mr. Key, I asked him the question yesterday as to whether he thought it was time to readmit Fiji to the forum. But in his answer, he spoke about, you know, there being positive developments, but he is not in favour of it coming up immediately at this forum. And this is what he said.
It should be a strong message that says they've taken some of the right steps in terms of the constitutional reform. The next really important step is holding free and fair elections. I'm not of the view that Fiji should be allowed back into the forum, or there should be a dramatic change in the approach taken by the forum until they actually hold those elections. We're getting pretty close to the finishing line, and we need to actually get over that line before we reinstate them.
John Key, Prime Minister of New Zealand. Sean Dorney, so there seems to be a wait-and-see attitude to some of the leaders.
Yes, and I asked also Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister, Peter O'Neill, and he said, yes, it would depend upon the elections in his view, and that it would be another year before they made a decision. Now, those elections are scheduled for September, late September, we believe, next year, so that could be after the next Pacific Islands Forum. So it's my expectation that the decision coming out on Fiji today will be one to say, yes, there's been positive progress made. We're pleased that there is now a constitution that's going to be put in place and progress to the elections will help with the elections. Peter O'Neill spoke about the support Papua New Guinea is giving to Fiji for those elections, but readmission to the forum does seem as though it's at least a year and a bit away.
The managing director of ExxonMobil's huge Papua New Guinea liquid natural gas project says he would like to double the size of the project and is working fast so he can do so. The $19 billion project is the biggest ever undertaken in Papua New Guinea and could transform the country. Jemiah Garrett has the story.
Earlier this week, the PNG LNG project announced it's 90% complete and on track to deliver first gas to its customers in the second half of 2014. Its plant near Port Moresby has two processing trains, and it's so big, each of its gas storage tanks are large enough to fit a Boeing 747 aircraft inside. But even before its plant is fully tested, the project is looking at a major expansion plan. Peter Graham, managing director of Exxon subsidiary Esso Highlands, says he has a number of new sources of gas. He's not coy when asked how fast he's moving to develop them.
I would say as fast as we practically can. I mean, obviously there is a lot of work needed to be done to prove up reserves. That takes some time. Typically there is drilling involved and then certification of the reserves once the drilling results are in, engineering studies and the like. So it does take a number of years to get to a stage where we'll have another train complete. So we're optimistic and have a very active program underway to move expansion plans forward as fast as we practically can.
You've only just started on the difficult task of testing and commissioning the first two processing trains at your plant in Port Moresby. What makes you so sure that you can cope with major expansion plans at the same time?
I think our track record speaks for itself. I mean, you look at where we are today, roll back the clock several years, there were lots of sceptics who didn't think a project could be executed in Papua New Guinea. I say look at where we are today, 90% complete. Many aspects of the project, in fact, complete. I think our track record, as I say, speaks for itself.
Gas demand in the Asia-Pacific region is at an all-time high and prices are strong. David Lennox, resource analyst with the Sydney-based stockbroking firm Fat Profits, says prices are likely to stay strong for the next 3 to 4 years.
The demand out of Asia for clean LNG is actually growing quite significantly, and that's a result of the events of Fukushima and the nuclear accident there, and of course the debates that the world is having on global warming. So that's placed LNG in a real sweet spot to be a provider of energy into the Asia region.
So how well placed is the PNG LNG project to take advantage of this sweet spot?
Oh, look, we think it's certainly very well placed. Like Pluto, when it rolled off this year, it will gain significant advantage in terms of cash flows through higher LNG prices and also the ability to lock in long-term contracts now with once they start delivering, that ability to deliver in the future.
The PNG LNG project has good additional gas prospects in at least three provinces. Managing Director Peter Graham says Interoil's Elk Antelope resource, for which negotiations are in progress, could provide sufficient gas for expansion.
Sufficient for one train, one additional train at least. It'll depend, obviously, on how much gas there is, and that's yet to be defined. I think before any expansion project goes forward based on any resource, there's going to need to be a definition of what reserves are available. And that's true as well for the Elk Antelope resource.
There is room, I understand, for 5 processing trains at your Port Moresby plant site. Could expansion plans get as ambitious as that?
We'd like to think so. I think in the near term, being realistic, it's move one train at a time. It's quite a challenge, obviously, building not just the LNG plant itself, but the upstream facilities that provide the gas. So a phased development or expansion, I think, is most likely.
In Australia and elsewhere in the Asia Pacific, there's a huge pipeline of new gas projects jostling to get to market. David Lennox says the PNG LNG project is in the front line.
It's really the next main LNG project in the Australian region to hit the production lines.
If the PNG LNG project goes to 5 processing trains, where would that put it in terms of the rankings of new gas projects?
Look, that would make it a significant. That would probably put it up with the Grogan-type LNG projects.
So that would make it one of the biggest in the world?
It would certainly make it a significant project, yes. And we do think that there is enough gas in the region of where the trains are being built, up in the highlands of PNG and also in the offshore regions, that the move to additional trains is probably to be expected.
How would a major expansion of the PNG LNG project affect its profitability?
Oh, look, no doubt that once you've sunk the capital costs, it is easier to just bolt on additional trains at lesser of a capital cost. If those trains can deliver natural gas into a higher pricing environment, that would be very profitable for the group.
How soon does the project need to get those trains up and running to take advantage of this sweet spot?
Oh, no doubt, as soon as possible. As we said earlier, LNG will start coming out of the current project site from 2014. If they do build additional trains, they would get those trains probably built in a shorter time. We'd be looking within 3 years for the increased capacity to hit the markets.
Next on the program, we talk about traveling. Now, I love traveling by motorcycle. I've traveled through Russia, China, and also a number of other countries as well. But a group from New Zealand has done something that not too many can claim that they've done. A group of New Zealand adventurers has successfully crossed over from Pyongyang into South Korea on motorcycles. In a feat, Pyongyang says it's the first of its kind. Foreigners wishing to travel between the two Koreas usually have to fly via Beijing. But after more than 6 years of discussions with North Korean authorities, permission was finally granted to the bikers to cross the demilitarized zone that split the two Koreas. Tom Maddox has more.
Okay, so we've finally cleared North Korean customs immigration, and finally, just as you can probably see, we're now in South Korea, and this is the media circus that we've arrived to. So this is quite amazing. Gareth's doing a speech there. Just people everywhere.
That's one of the travelling team members, filming an enormous media scrum gathered around Gareth and Joanne Morgan. The adventurers had just crossed the Demilitarised Zone, or DMZ, the heavily fortified frontier dividing North and South Korea. The group's leader, New Zealand businessman Gareth Morgan, describes the warm reception they received upon crossing.
So we had this 300 metres between where the North Koreans left us, and then we rode to where four soldiers were waiting, two Americans and two New Zealanders, and they gave us a great welcome and said they couldn't believe that it had happened and they were really pleased to see us. And then we cleared customs and I said, oh, that's good. That's all clear now. And he said, no, it's not. Have a look at the top of that building. And on top of the building was just this massive array of television cameras and photographers. I didn't know whether the reception in the south would be friendly or hostile. Well, it was amazingly friendly, of course.
Only 24 hours before the group was due to cross the DMZ, Gareth Morgan explains, a communication breakdown meant the transition from north to south may not have been so smooth.
They said to us, well, we can't be sure this is going to work, so we want you to take additional food, we want you to take water, and we know you've got tents, because we're going to drop you off in the middle of the zone, and whether or not they pick you up, we're going to leave you there, because we don't want to be accused of not doing what we said we'd do. So it gives you a bit of a window as to how sensitive the relationship is.
The group began their journey in Russia's Far East, then made their way west across the Siberian Mountains, around the border with China, until finally they dropped into North Korea. 9 months and 40,000 kilometres later, they're planning to arrive back home in New Zealand. They've been blogging their experiences along the way, and now, having passed successfully from the north to the south, Gareth Morgan has a message for those back home. He says the West needs to rethink its ideas about Korea.
And so far as what has been the nature of the media inquiries, they really just want to know, what did you see? You know, what were the people like? Did you get to speak to people, or is that prohibited? Because the stereotypical imagery of North Korea that you get, I think, from this almost concerted effort to demonise the place and capitalise on the fact we're all ignorant, is that it must be like one giant prison camp. Nothing could be further from the truth.
He acknowledges North Korea is an authoritarian regime, but says preconceptions that the people are starving is actually not true. He says the group found people were eating well and local crops were healthy. Farming is self-sufficient, labour-intensive, but very productive. The problem is that the country's sanctions mean there are no reserves. South Korea's unification ministry said it approved the crossing since the event would help promote peace on the Korean Peninsula. The mood on the Korean Peninsula has improved in recent months. The two Koreas are taking tentative steps to revive a number of border projects, including reopening the Kaesong Joint Industrial Zone.
And with that, we end this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. You can catch another edition on Sunday at 1330 UTC for listeners in Southeast and East Asia on 11,835 kilohertz. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Perron saying so long, take care. We'll see you in 7 days. Bye-bye.